Hi, I'm Carmen LaBurge. Thanks for listening to the podcast of Mornings with Carmen LaBurge.
Today is the day you have made. I will rejoice and be glad in it. Today is the day you have made. I will rejoice and be glad in it. And I won't worry about tomorrow. I'm trusting.
Indeed, today is the day. It is Wednesday, July the 10th, 2019. Good morning. Thank you for taking me along wherever it is that you are headed this morning. Let me open this morning with this question. What is truth? Like, it's a provocative question. It's a question that is on hearts and minds in every generation, in every time and place. What is truth? And how can I know the truth? And what do I do with the truth? Can I handle the truth? Do I handle the truth well? The dictionary might define the truth as something that is verified or an indisputable fact, which, of course, in the culture today provokes an interesting conversation in and of itself. What is an indisputable fact? Is it a proposition, a principle? Is truth a state or a character of being? That is one perspective on the truth. Now, you and I, as Christians, would say that the full truth, the whole truth, the nothing but the truth reality is actually God himself. And so the Bible offers us the truth about everything that's necessary for life and godliness. But you and I have people who help us see the truth in stories around us all the time. And that's a conversation that I want to embark on today with actually a religion reporter from the Washington Post. So first up this morning, I'm letting you know we have a real treat. Michelle Boorstein is here from the Washington Post. She is a religion reporter. And she and I are going to talk about religion reporting and its impact and effect on all of us. So I thought I would open with a few verses from Scripture about the truth to encourage us in our walk of faith today. Psalm 25:5 says, "Lead me in your truth and teach me, for you are the God of my salvation. For you I wait all day long." The Gospel of John is a good place to turn if you are looking for information about the truth and the person of Jesus as the way and the truth and the life. That's also the gospel where the conversation with Pilate takes place, who asks, what is truth, or what does truth have to do with it? And then in the book of Ephesians, I would encourage you to read chapters 4, 5, and 6, which also talk about the truth. That's where we find the speaking the truth in love encouragement or command, and that we would each and everyone grow up in every way into him who is the head, into Christ. Well, that's the one who comes full of grace and truth. So if you and I are going to be people who represent God well in the world today, we are going to be people of truth. And not just partial truth, but the whole truth. And not just the truth sometimes, but nothing but the truth all times in every place and in every way. And sometimes that is difficult to speak. It's often difficult to hear, but the truth ultimately matters. And so we trust journalists to tell us the truth about what's going on in the world. And one of those truth tellers is Michelle Boorstein from The Washington Post. She's a religion reporter, and she's up next here on Mornings with Carmen.
If I should speak, then let it be of the grace that is greater than all my sin.
Joining me now is Michelle Boorstein. Michelle is a Washington, D.C. based religion reporter currently at The Washington Post, but spent a lot of time with the AP. In the past decade, she has been named three times the Religion Reporter of the Year by the Religion News Writers Association. Those listening in Wisconsin will appreciate that she's a badger. Michelle says her path to her dream job as a religion reporter began as a kid trying to make sense of a kosher Jewish home that had three sets of dishes. You can follow her on Twitter at Michelle Boorstein, and you can find her at The Washington Post. Michelle, welcome to Mornings with Carmen.
Thank you, Carmen. I appreciate it.
Would you like to give a shout out to all the people in Wisconsin today?
Yeah, I was really proud also of the women's soccer team. The second winning goal was scored by a Badger. So
there you go. There you go. See, it's always good to give a little shout out to the local folks. I love it. So, Michelle, let's just start with this wide open question. What is a religion reporter?
So a religion reporter, I mean, today, obviously, the media is much more diverse than it was back decades ago when I started. There's so many different outlets and, you know, different types of people bringing information. But so basically, a religion reporter is someone who's trying to cover the news of religion. That's become more complicated because, you know, when I began covering religion in 2006, I think we were more focused in this country on denominations. So like the Religion News Writers Association, for example, began as people meeting at denominational meetings like the Southern Baptist Convention or the Episcopal Church Convention or the Catholic Bishops Meeting. And now, you know, a quarter of the country practically is unaffiliated. And many people who say they have a religion are not necessarily affiliated. So people are not as glued into, you know, the votes of these different bodies. And it's just a much more, you know, we're covering everything from, you know, what makes people look at somebody like Oprah as a spiritual figure to church state debates to, you know, theological discussions to, you know, a lot of people are very interested in accountability today. So, you know, what are religious, powerful religious figures and organizations doing wrong that they're covering up that we can try to bring to light? So we try to do a little bit of everything. I mean, but like I said, when I started, I think we were still more focused on, but I remember when I started being a religion reporter, I actually went back to the dictionary and I was like, what am I covering? Because it's just such a complicated word. I mean, I'm sure a lot of your listeners know that some people don't even like to use that word. You know, they don't like to consider themselves religious because they feel like that's too much about the institution. And, you know, people looking for other words, you know, that are more just about their devotion to God and not connected to something that's more earthly, like, you know, these institutions or churches that they think may or may not be, you know, going the right way. So anyway, that's a long way of saying we try to cover everything. We try to cover things that help people understand religion as a force in America. And that's religion, faith, spirituality, ethics. But there's, you know, that's a pretty big ground. So people do it different ways. But that's how I see it. I want people to read our stories and feel, you know, in 10 or 20 or 50 years, like, yeah, they were prepared to understand things based on the stories that we write.
I often think about it as the person who is helping me understand my neighbor whose faith I do not necessarily share anymore. I think that maybe there's a generation of people who have assumed that everybody around them believes the same thing that they believe. And I, Michelle, we're now all awake to the fact that that is absolutely not the case. Those right. around me in my immediate environment, maybe even those within my own home, do not necessarily share my beliefs. And certainly the person who is the new immigrant or the person with whom I am trying to have peace around the world does not necessarily share my faith. In fact, almost certainly does not. And so I think that, you know, I think that part of the role that is so essential in religion reporting today is helping people of faith understand other people of faith or people of other faiths and or no faith, like, you know. And so I think that's an important part of the conversation that we're all trying to have in the culture today. So with all of that in mind, obviously, religion reporters are not necessarily people of faith themselves. And they're certainly not necessarily a person who shares the faith of the faith that they're covering in a particular story. Just talk about that. The reality that reporters are people too, and have their own set of their own set of beliefs. I think that it would be helpful for listeners to understand how journalists operate in this faith sphere or in this religious sphere.
Well, I mean, there's just like you said, you know, reporters are people too. And I think people, you know, religion reporters, of which there's not a ton, it's not like political reporting or sports reporting where there's, you know, we're one of the smaller teams.
It, of course, should be.
Yes, you're preaching to the choir, so to speak. But yeah, no, I think so there's different, you know, if you went to a religion reporter conference, you'd see people of all different faiths who are motivated to devote their life to that or devote some segment of their life to covering religion for different reasons. People might have, you know, their own journey of something they're trying to understand or something they think needs to be elevated more, you know, or it could be, you know, there's a variety of reasons why people, you know, find religion fascinating and want to write about it. But I think in our country, we just first of all, to what you said, which is a lot of people still are largely around people who are somewhat similar to them, but less so than in the past. And or maybe, you know, aren't comfortable talking openly about what they believe. I mean, I've found that even people who, you know, could be churchgoers their whole life, they may or may not be comfortable speaking certain beliefs or certain questions or certain certain leanings that they have, even to, you know, to other people, to themselves. And they're certainly not comfortable asking other people. And then I think there's also this feeling, like you said in the intro about truth, I mean, religion's something where I mean, not everybody is in the spiritual practice to search for the ultimate truth, but a lot of people are. And I think it's a difficult, sensitive topic to engage with other people who, you know, may, like you said, may not share your belief, or you may be figuring out your own belief and you don't really know who to trust. So I think for religion reporters, they just have to get really comfortable and confident with that whole messiness. You know, people ask me about my religious faith all the time, and I was raised in a conservative Jewish home. The thing you mentioned about the plates was, I don't know if people will find something to relate to this, but in a kosher home where you're observing the kashrut, the Jewish dietary laws, usually there's milk and meat, and everything is separated in that way because you're not supposed to mix milk and meat. But in our home, we had milk and meat, and then in the back section, we had plates for Chinese food. That was the third set of plates that I was like, what is this about? You know, we're following these rules all the time, but yet we're violating them with this other set of plates. So what is that about? And I actually think it is kind of a metaphor where people, you know, are trying to make sense of what feels true to them and trying to find a practice that is meaningful and true to them. And trying to carry on, you know, especially when you're in a small minority or cultural faith, you know, tradition and sort of that important piece. So a lot of it is just, there's a lot of pieces to what make up somebody's religious identity. And I always, the plates thing is just a funny way of sort of the contradictions, you know, the contradictions and the different paths, the different ways that people practice Christianity or practice Judaism or Islam or Hinduism or whatever. And you have to kind of sort that stuff out. And I think there's so much humanity in that, and that's what I was always attracted to. So I try to, you know, I've become, since I've been doing this for a long time, I'm, you know, relatively, you know, I know a little bit about lots of things. So I'm pretty knowledgeable about it. And I think it's just given me the confidence to go when people ask me questions or challenge me. I don't feel threatened in any way. I mean, I feel like it's such a privilege to be a journalist, and it's such an important role that I feel that we play, and I want to do it right. And being defensive doesn't get me anywhere. I just want to learn about the people that I cover, and I want to cover them accurately. So, you know, I definitely get asked, you know, about my faith a lot, or people obviously want to share their faith or share their, you know, their discouragement with faith or, you know, strong feelings about, you know, non-belief or whatever. And I just think, you know, in a way, being a journalist is kind of, it's not a bad thing to try out for people.
Exactly.
Like to try the experience of, yeah, just that you're wanting to understand. My job is not to advocate or to, you know, preach to anybody. My job is to really listen and reflect back what I'm hearing. Of course, I bring my own life to that. And I have biases that I have to look at clearly. But, you know, so there's people that, you know, you're never going to make everybody happy with the stories that you do about faith, because often people want to hear things through their own lens and they feel that that's the only accurate way. But that's just not possible, you know. So hopefully we build, you know, enough, you know, trust and, you know, faith in what we do that people understand we're telling you the truth as best we can see it. We can't, there's lots of things we don't see and we don't know. And this is just a part of your education, but
exactly.
But it's something that you should, you know, we try to look at things with an open mind and, you know, just deliver information that's useful to readers.
Okay, so Michelle Borstein and I are going to be right back, and we're going to actually be talking about a story that's posted at thewashingtonpost.com. It is a religion story, and it speaks to the challenge of religious diversity, that's something that we all face in the culture, but imagine the challenge of a public school teacher who is facing questions from students and students who are operating from faith systems with which they are not familiar. So we're going to talk about that right up next, right after a really quick break. Returning to my conversation with Michelle Borstein of The Washington Post. She's a religion reporter. You can follow her on Twitter at M. Borstein. You can also find her at WashingtonPost.com. You've got a piece posted at The Post by one of your colleagues. It occurs to me that religion reporting is not really competitive. It is genuinely collaborative, and I love that about this particular field. So tell us about this piece by Julie, and I might mispronounce her last name, Zosmer. Am I even close?
Good. Okay. Yes, you are.
And it's on how complicated this space is for school teachers. So just walk us through this story, because I just think it's great.
Yeah, actually, so Julie did a story a few months ago about sort of a concerted effort by some advocacy groups that are trying to get the Bible, as in the Christian Bible, you know, brought in through electives into public schools. And so there, this was sort of a follow-up. Then she had another story this week about a very diverse community outside of Washington called Montgomery County, and teachers, public school teachers, who take a class about world religions, basically trying to educate themselves about different religions, but also to educate themselves about something I think many Americans know very little about, which is the legal right to teach about religion in public schools. And obviously we know there's a big political cultural component to this, the whole shorthand, you know, the Bible going out of schools. And I think a lot of people don't know the law, don't know that, you know, that it is absolutely legal to teach about religion in an academic setting in a way that's not advocating for one particular faith. But I mean, the story reflected that a lot of teachers don't know that. They, you know, kind of the last few decades, people have felt this is such an explosive, sensitive topic, I'll just ignore it. And a period of like declining religious literacy. So even if I wanted to address it, I don't know how to speak about it. So she followed these teachers that were, you know, basically going to different places of worship and learning about, you know, law and that kind of thing. And I just thought it was fascinating because I remember when I started covering religion in 2006, one of the first events I went to was a conference that had a really diverse group of people. Richard Land was there, who was the policy guy for the Southern Baptist Convention, and the ACLU were there, and all different people. And they were coming together to try to discuss teaching about religion in public schools, because there was this feeling like this is this topic that is so explosive, and is there a way to do it legally? How can we do it? You know, and putting together standards, there being, you know, efforts for people who do want to do this to, you know, to explain how to do it legally. But it's just, I feel like we're just in this, I mean, this is my one area where I do feel like I do have a bit of bias, where I really feel that it's so crazy that we don't teach about religion in the public schools so that people can understand the laws, the culture, the internal debates. I mean, it's not enough to say Christian, Jewish, you know, Muslim at all, because we all know that there's a million ways of practicing these faiths. And it's just an area that we have a lot of ignorance about in our country. So anyway, I just thought the story was about these teachers, you know, getting all Julie showed images of the teacher of the teachers quizzing them about religious facts and how little they knew. And that they wanted to help their students, whether they were teaching literature. She talked about, you know, the religious context of Romeo and Juliet, and she talked about Raisin in the Sun, and sort of not knowing how to talk about religion and abortion in public, just that teachers not feeling like they had enough information to talk knowledgeably and legally about religion and so many topics that our lives intersect with. So maybe the next generation will take it up more. We'll have more confidence confidence in sort of their ability to navigate the pluralism. But anyway, yeah, it was really, I mean, the religion in public schools thing is such an explosive and important subject.
So the other story that that caught my attention yesterday at the Washington Post, which you and I will not have time to talk about today, but I found fascinating. It's this piece about Democratic candidates who are hiring faith outreach directors, and you know, and who the, to whom they are going to be reaching out. I thought that was fascinating. That's a piece. If folks want to find it, it's actually a July 5th piece. Tara Burton has it posted at WashingtonPost.com. I just really want to encourage our listeners to read widely and certainly read religion reporters. Michelle Borstein is one of them. Michelle, thank you so much for being with us today on Mornings with Carmen. You guys can find her on Twitter.
Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. At M. Borstein. And you can also find her at TheWashingtonPost.com. You're listening to Mornings with Carmen. We'll be right back.
You're a good, good father. It's who you are.
So recently, the State Department has launched a new commission on unalienable rights. And there are some people who are voicing opposition to the creation of this commission on unalienable rights. Now, immediately when we say unalienable rights, our minds go to certain sentences of declaration of our unalienable rights. And we recognize that those come from a creator. I'm going to have that conversation next with Hunter Baker from Union University. He and I are going to talk about unalienable rights. We're going to talk about this new commission. And we're going to talk maybe also about, if I can carve out the time, an example of this debate or discourse about what is religious liberty and who gets to define it in this sort of hierarchy of rights conversation we're having today in the culture. That's up next here on Mornings with Carmen.
What does money have the power to do? From song lyrics to life experience, we know some of the things it can't do. Money can't buy you love. It doesn't bring happiness, make you smarter, or give self-esteem. Hi, this is Callie Breeze with your Thrivent Money Journey moment. In and of itself, money has no power. It is only a tool. No matter how much money you have, God gives you the freedom to make choices about money. He also says he'll give you wisdom to guide those choices. Money is a tool that can be used to prepare for the unexpected. It allows you to plan for the future, to provide stability in your community, and a way to support your church. By itself, money has no power. What you choose to do with it creates all of money's clout. So, how will you choose to use money today?
Dr. Hunter Baker has both a JD and a PhD. He serves as the Dean of the College of Arts and Science. He's a university fellow and associate professor of political science at Union University in Jackson, Tennessee. He's the author of several books. He also serves as an associate editor for the Journal of Markets and Morality. He's a contributing editor for Touchstone, which is a journal of mere Christianity. He's a research fellow at the Ethics and Religious Liberty Commission and co-founder of The City. He blogs at hunterbaker.wordpress.com. And I love to talk with him at the intersection of politics and faith and ethics. And so, Hunter, welcome back.
I'm so happy to be with you. Thank you.
So I know that one thing that you have top of mind this morning is Ross Perot. So let's just start there. Ross Perot is now no longer meddling in. Oh, that's not the right way to say that. Ross Perot has gone from this life on to the next, and he will no longer be a disruptor. But he is a good person to talk about in terms of disruptive politics.
He really is. I was just kind of thinking about his legacy. And, you know, it may seem to a lot of people that Ross Perot kind of emerged in the 1992 to run for president and, you know, made a splash and then faded. And that was it. But the reality is that A, Ross Perot may have given us Bill Clinton as president. That's one thing. It's entirely possible that George H.W. Bush would have had his second term without Perot's entry into the race and winning almost 20% of the votes, running against public debt primarily. The other thing is, though, and this is the part that is really interesting, Perot debated Al Gore on the North American Free Trade Agreement and seemed to lose that debate, but that issue did not go away. And I think that if you were to check with the American people now, it would seem that Ross Perot's position has kind of come out on top, or at least much more even. And when you look at Donald Trump as a candidate, you cannot help but look back to that previous sort of independent billionaire Ross Perot. I am highly confident that many of the Perot voters are now Trump voters.
Yeah, I think that's probably a very accurate analysis. I'd like to pivot to a conversation about the State Department's new Commission on Unalienable Rights, because there's a lot of folks who are excited about it, and there are others who are very much not excited about it. Let's just start with the question of what is and is it inalienable or unalienable right?
People use both. It's a really interesting question. I think that so obviously it's part of the American heritage. The United States is sort of famous for being a country that is not founded on an ethnic group so much as that it is founded on a proposition or a set of ideals. And those inalienable or unalienable rights are part of that. Part of what you're trying to get at with something like that is that regardless of the type of government that you have, you know, whether it's a monarchy, an aristocracy, a democracy, are there certain rights that human beings should have in every political context? And so that's what the attempt is, to try to define those. The biggest sort of recent event for that was the United Nations Declaration of Human Rights, I think from 1948. And that was really really partly in response to sort of shocking discoveries about Nazi Germany and what had happened there, you know, with regard to the Holocaust and other events that had happened within Nazi Germany at the time. And is there a need, right, to kind of put firmly in the public conscience and in the conscience of nations a recognition of those fundamental human rights?
Okay, and so if you were going to articulate the most basic fundamental human right that is unalienable, if we were only going to pick one, what would it be?
The right to life.
I'm so glad that that was your answer, because that would have been my answer. And then I think we have to immediately pause and say, that's a huge, complex debate in America today, whether or not the right to life is actually the primary unalienable or inalienable right. And so if we can't even get to that one, you see my challenge here?
Well, I think that everybody would embrace the right to life. It's just that some people locate that right differently, right? You know, I mean, some people, it's frightening. Some people would locate that right at birth, right? That, of course, is sort of the fundamental debate in the debate over abortion. But some people would even locate that right later than birth. You know, 6 weeks after birth, maybe even up to a year after birth, depending on who you're talking about. That is part of the debate.
Okay, so this commission is going to advise the Secretary of State and is really going to be advising not only U.S. Policy here at home, but really primarily globally. This is really a conversation that's global. And so during the press conference on Monday, Mike Pompeo, our Secretary of State, argued that the commission's creation comes at a time when there's much confusion among nation states and international institutions about their respective responsibilities concerning human rights. Tell us what we think we know already about this particular commission or advisory committee, maybe is another word for it, and what we think they're going to do.
Yeah, I think there are two primary issues. One issue is that the United Nations has developed kind of a bad reputation for including serious human rights abusers, say maybe Iran or Venezuela, on things like the Council on Human Rights. They err on the side of including everyone in that work, even if you're including people who clearly do not prioritize human rights. So that would be one thing. The other thing is having to do with human sexuality. My suspicion is, and I think this is probably pretty easy to see, is that the sort of the sexuality discourse, the sort of that never-ending acronym, LGBTQIA, whatever else is added, that is becoming sort of the primary focus of human rights advocacy today. And what Pompeo is probably seeing is an effort to turn that agenda into the primary agenda of human rights work around the world. And so he's probably trying to get this group together, an advisory group, not a policymaking group, to sort of debate human rights and to refocus, what are we really doing here? And where does the sexuality stuff fit into that?
OK, so you have absolutely put your finger on what I believe is without question the point of all of this. And the way I have heard it articulated is that this is an attempt to place religious liberty above LGBTQ or SOGI rights in a hierarchy of rights. So when we come back from the break, Hunter, I would like for you to address the concept of a hierarchy of rights. Are there some rights that are, frankly, bigger and more significant than other rights? And who confers those rights? If we're going to use the word unalienable. So this conversation is going to continue with Dr. Hunter Baker from Union University as he and I try to think in public about the things that are going on at the intersection of politics and religion today. You're listening to Mornings with Carmen, and we'll be right back. Continuing my conversation with Dr. Hunter Baker from Union University, you can read what Hunter is writing at his blog, hunterbaker.wordpress.com. You can also follow him on Twitter at Hunter Baker. Hunter, I think that this conversation about inalienable or unalienable rights and the question of whether or not there's a hierarchy of rights is going to be the conversation going forward for some period of time. At the intersection of politics and religion here in this country. And so it's a conversation on the one hand where people would say my religious liberty, my religious convictions, the teachings of my faith and my faith community guide me in my understanding of what it means to be human, guide me in my understanding of what it means to be married, guide me in my understanding of what it means to be a parent, guide me in my understanding of sexuality and gender. And on the other hand, we have people who are saying, but I am free to express my sexuality in any way that I see fit. And you cannot take away that right. And so we have this contest of rights between what is framed as religious liberty on the one hand and what is framed as sexual liberty or SOGI laws or LGBTQ advocacy on the other hand. Do you think that I am seeing things accurately in terms of the ethical sort of contest in the culture today? And is there a hierarchy of rights? And if so, how do we figure it out?
Yeah, you clearly are seeing things correctly. That is what has happened. The problem is that human rights, it's always been a difficult subject. Jacques Maritain, Biden, who is one of the sort of the key movers in the UN Declaration on Human Rights, he said that we can kind of come to an agreement about what these rights are as long as we don't discuss where they come from. And so what you may get from that statement is the question of God, right?
Mm-hmm,
So do you see the transcendent God as being before politics, above politics, and the relationship of the human being to God being before politics and above politics and more fundamental than politics? And does that then, is that really the source of rights? And of course, I'm sure that you, like I do, see any rights that we have outside of our political arrangements would be from God, right? You know, from endowed, something with which we are endowed as human beings made in God's image, and therefore sharing in this special dignity, sort of this family of God, the family of creatures with whom he has given reason. So that's sort of the standard account of human rights. We are moving more toward a human rights of, I want to call it group opinion. I wish I had a different name for that, but it's more of, I think, more of kind of a pagan conception of sort of, well, what are the rights that we sort of agree to? And that sounds good, but the problem is that can easily take you to a place where some pretty fundamental rights like religious liberty are not respected.
And I think that if I were going to use a word that we have used here before, and that's the concept of autonomy, there seems to be this casting off or throwing off of any authority that God might have as the creator and therefore giver of any and every right. And if I deny that there is a God, then I can also deny that there's any authority beyond or above myself. And if the self becomes the primary authority, then every self around the globe is equal in its autonomous imaginings. And that's not going to work.
No, it clearly won't work. And the thing is the question is, so we have this this sort of argument about like you say, sexual autonomy, right? And sexual autonomy is supposed to trump a person's autonomy with regard to religion, right? And the question is, why? Why is
yes,
that?
Yes, why? Why?
And
yes.
And the only the only answer that I think the left could give to that question is, well, because the D.C., Hollywood, New York Fortune 500 nexus says so, right? I mean, it's just sort of a power thing. But if power is going to call the tune on rights, then I'm not sure we can meaningfully speak of rights.
Well, I think you're right. I think you're right.
No pun intended.
So, Hunter, will you continue to help us think in public about these things and continue to apply the mind of Christ on the matters of the day? Because I think that every Christian in the culture today really needs help on this particular front. We need to understand what's going on, and then we need to be equipped to be able to walk our faith out into the world where these conversations are taking place every single day. And we need to do so in ways that honor Jesus. So will you continue to help us do that?
Well, it's a privilege to have the opportunity.
All right. So Hunter Baker, thank you so much. You guys can check out what Hunter is working on, hunterbaker.wordpress.com. You can follow him on Twitter at Hunter Baker, and we will talk with him again soon. We'll be right back. So the conversation that emerges out of the one that I just had with Hunter Baker is the conversation about discrimination. And that is actually how you will hear this couched in most of your conversations in the culture. The question won't be how are my religious liberty rights or my right to religious freedom, how is that preserved in the context of a culture and a conversation where someone wants to have their particular sexual expression or gender expression affirmed, even in contradiction to my conscience. And what you're going to hear is that's really a question of discrimination. And so I think that you and I have to, I know that this is complicated, heady stuff for first thing in the morning, and I get that, but this is where the rubber meets the road in the conversations and the culture today. And so you and I, as what I'll describe as culture gardeners, as you and I are out there tilling the soil in the culture today, as you and I are trying to remove the rocks that set themselves in opposition or pretense against the word of God, we can't just be people who enter into those conversations unaware of or unconcerned about the person with whom we're talking, because the person with whom we're talking has a serious concern and issue in their heart and in their life, or they would not be coming in opposition to the word of God at these points. And so let us be people who are not only full of truth, which is essential, but also full of grace. And I want us in these worldview conversations to be people who are gospel oriented, are gospel centered, are redemptive in our approach. So I want you to think for just a moment. I want you to get somebody clearly in view in your heart and mind. Who in your life sees your worldview, your religious perspective as discriminatory against them? Who in your life views you as a bigot? And now, before you do anything else, I want you to pray for that individual by name. Lift them up by the power of the Holy Spirit, the access that Christ gives you. Lift that person up before the Father right now. Just say, Father, I present this person before you. I simply intercede on their behalf. We'll be right back.
Thanks for listening to this podcast of Mornings with Carmen LaBurge from Faith Radio. If you haven't, you can subscribe to automatically receive the podcast through iTunes or the Google Play Music app. That way, you never miss an episode. It's also available anytime at myfaithradio.com.